From WXXI, this is Connections, filling in for Evan Dawson. I'm Gino Finelli. Today's Connection was made on January 25th. That was the day the annual point in time, or PIT, count was done on Monroe County's homeless population. The count offers a snapshot of the population currently living in shelters, emergency housing, or on the street. The results of that count were released last week and showed a worsening issue in Rochester and the surrounding community. The number of the people on the street was almost double the previous year, and the total population counted reached over 1,000 for the first time in over a decade. The rising number is attributed to a slew of factors, including the end of the pandemic-era eviction moratorium and rising housing costs in the area. So to talk about the situation among Rochester's homeless population, I'm joined by Andy Carey of Reach Advocacy and Project Haven, which operates 6 shelters in Rochester. Andy, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Gino.
Anna Valeria of the Shelter Open Door Mission. Anna, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Gino.
And Connie Sanderson of Partners Ending Homelessness, the organization which performs the PIT count. Connie, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So what I wanted to start here by doing is give an opportunity for all of you who work directly with this population and are very well-versed in the issues facing it to give a bit of background on what you've been seeing over, you know, the past, you know, 3, 4, or 5 years. Andy, I want to start with you there. In the shelters. You see what's going on. So I just want to give a chance for you to talk about it.
Yeah, thank you very much. I've been really fortunate to be able to be in the shelters, on the streets, in people's apartments, all over the community for a long time now. And it feels like homelessness in general has steadily been increasing. We've seen it for years. I think it was probably about a decade ago when Anna probably prognosticated that there would be a huge family homeless issue coming up. And That call was absolutely right. And then in my world, I work a lot more with individuals on the streets, and we've seen an increase of people living in abandoned homes, tents, you know, just on the streets in general. And, you know, I attribute that to opioid epidemic, access to mental health treatment, but also just to the housing crisis in general that we have in Rochester. So, I felt year after year I've been saying that this is the worst I've ever seen it, and it just continues down that path. So.
And is that what you're seeing as well? Is this as bad as it's ever been?
Absolutely. And unfortunately, these numbers, I know they were kind of came across as surprising to everyone. They were not at all surprising to us. Andy sees this too in the work that we do. We not only see the numbers that we see on paper, but we see the numbers that are not represented on paper and in counts. So like Andy said, you know, we've been talking about the family homelessness issue for a very long time. That's why we started our cold water program for homeless women and children. And so there's a little bit of this that's nice to see that some of these numbers are finally being recognized, but it's not nearly representative of the problem that we're seeing. We are seeing more and more families than ever. We've had to add components to our budget just to be able to place people because it's harder to place families in mainstream shelter systems, and it's harder for them to qualify for certain housing options and resources because oftentimes families are staying in unstable situations where they're what's called doubled up. They're not necessarily, many of them are staying in cars, but a lot of them are staying in places. They're sleeping on floors and couches. So, you know, one resource might say, well, that's not really homeless. You know, we have inconsistent definitions of homelessness between federal departments like Department of Ed and Department of HUD. So some things, kind of boil down to this lack of consistency among resources. But the reality is it is a heartbreaking situation for families. And we're working with so many of them, families with adult children, small children, and the problem is becoming worse.
So I think the PIT count itself is a very good metric for being able to get some kind of understanding of what's been happening. But it has its limitations, too, as you're pointing to. Connie, I want to give you a chance to kind of explain like how the PIT count works, what mm-hmm. it does, and what those figures actually represent.
So just from the start, it does count people who are what's considered to be what's called literally homeless. So people mm-hmm. in shelters, other homeless transitional programs, unsheltered. It does not count people doubled up that Anna was just describing. So the count is done every year during the last week of January. It's the data is then collected and submitted to HUD, who then provides a report annually to Congress. It's called the AHAR report. And its intent is to give sort of a snapshot, a one-day snapshot of what homelessness looks like across the country. Those numbers can vary greatly throughout the year here in Rochester in terms of numbers. And, you know, surprisingly, numbers of singles go up during the winter. The summer, number of families tends to be greater. And that's always been the case. And we think part of that is that doubling up issue, that people are reluctant to ask people to leave their homes while their kids are still in school for that year. So they'll hold on to them, and then they'll end up entering the homeless system. You know, once the school year is done, whoever their hostess is just can't do it any longer.
One of the things I talked with all of you about when I was doing this story last week was the safety net that existed for families, that typically what was seen more often was people ended up staying with family and friends. And that doesn't seem to be as, you know, people are falling through the cracks more often now. And I want to get a sense of why you think that is, of what you think is happening there, where families are ending up in shelters that might not have previously ended up in shelters before. Andy, I'll start with you there, of like, you know, what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I think one thing that really struck me about a year ago, we're very close with the eviction marshal, because when he runs into people, he wants to make sure they can be housed somewhere. And it used to be that, you know, he'd put a 14-day notice on a door, and then by the time he got there to change the locks 2 weeks later, everyone would be gone, and you're just changing the locks. And nowadays, that's not the case. When he shows up, there's still people there. And so he's really hands-on in the eviction world. And when he's asking people, do you have family or friends you can go to, they say, well, it's already full. There's other family members there. It's doubled up, tripled up. And then also just the cost. I think general inflation, cost of food, this pressure that we're all feeling. Rents are going up, costs of everything. So bringing in another family can be really burdensome financially as well. So I think there's a lot to it, and there's a lot of bigger structural issues. But I think in general, it used to be that family would just find other family and friends and move in with them. And now that's not the case. So.
Anna, how often do you think you see families now that it's their first time entering into the system? Is it going up? Is that more common than it was before?
It's definitely going up, and almost all the families we're seeing, this is the first time entering the system. And really, if we're working with them, they're not actually entering the system because they're trying to avoid entering the system. So in order to keep them together, we are trying to house them, whether it's through our own properties or through, you know, motel stays, which are not ideal. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, again, they don't meet certain qualifications for other resources. So, you know, we're seeing a lot of families with adult children, intact families, where one person may be eligible for Social Security, but another person is not. So that person is deemed employable, but that person is actually caring for their partner. And so them trying to navigate the system where they just can't qualify for the resources lands them sleeping in laundromats and working with a family sleeping in a laundromat right now, in their cars. And if we can try to support them, you know, for hotels for a few days at a time as well.
Connie, I know that in some other cities that they apply a multiplier to the PIT count because it does have its limitations of reaching people that might be staying in vacant housing or in cars or something like that, that you can't count what you can't find. How representative do you think the PIT count is of, you know, the total number of homeless population that is in Monroe County right now?
So I think at least for sheltered people, it's fairly accurate. Mm-hmm. For unsheltered, it probably represents somewhat of an undercount, though I do think over the past couple of years, we've really expanded the number of volunteers who participate, and we are finding more. We do not go to abandoned houses on the night of the point in time count because of personal safety issues, because people may be living in an abandoned building, but it also may be a place where people are using substances and things that just isn't safe for people to enter without any sort of police support or something. So there probably is somewhat of an undercount there around abandoned buildings. But I don't think it's hundreds and hundreds of more people.
Gotcha. You know, this is an issue that's come up a lot when I was working in encampments and things like that, is when someone goes into a vacant house, it's almost like they are disappearing out of the system. Like, people can't reach them anymore. If we're looking at, like, people are, our systems are overlooking the homeless population as a whole. These are, like, the people that are overlooked in the overlooked, right? It's very, very difficult to really get any resources into there. It's very difficult to figure out how many people are actually staying in vacant housing. And Andy, you're involved in kind of the more street portion of what we have in Rochester with the population that we're seeing here. How difficult is that of, like, knowing where people are and where they're going when, you know, this is kind of the reality of it, is that sometimes people can go, we have lots of vacant housing in the city and people can go there and then they're, as far as anyone knows, they disappeared for a little while, as far as any of the systems know.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's always been, I like how Connie touched on that. That's been the most complicated of all issues, is that, first of all, just because it's an abandoned house, it's still private property. So you're trespassing if you go into it. And so volunteers, you don't want them trespassing and maybe going into a dangerous spot. And we literally have thousands of vacant homes. So to be able to check them all would be very difficult. So usually when I'm called to a vacant home, it's because neighbors know or someone has asked me to go there, and then I'm able to find people there. I have been surprised that it feels like more of the vacant homes are being used. And on occasion, I've gone to vacant homes now, and it's not individuals. It might be a family in there. And that's a little heartbreaking to see. So it's there's kind of a changing feel to the homelessness and in the abandoned houses. But I do think abandoned houses, or bandos as they call them, have really become a place of refuge, like a shelter outside the shelter system. And we all know it's a dangerous way to live. And so I think we could do better than that.
I would just add to that, too, to give Connie's team and their plan and Andy's team, who does a lot of that outreach. We're actually really blessed as a community to have so many teams doing outreach on such a regular basis. I know we're still not going to have that full count, but I think we do probably better than most. Between Andy's team and the teams that, you know, the COC puts together, and Nick's team, and just the multitude of volunteer community citizens who are just, like to do the street outreach and can help with that, that allows us as a community to better identify and be, consistently looking for those numbers, even though it's still an undercount. But I think we do better than most in that area too.
So, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, we don't count, they're not part of the count, unfortunately, but many of the people staying in abandoned homes or buildings or whatever are also showing up at the neighborhood food pantries, at the soup kitchens. So they're often, somebody knows who they are and knows that they're staying in a place in an abandoned building. They just haven't found any alternative to that for a variety of reasons.
So I have here a statement from the county that they want to add to this program. The first line of it is in regards to typo in the PIT report that Connie and I had spoke about this morning, and placed a number of individuals within the family unit as the household number. Even factoring in the correct household number, it's still the highest in well over a decade. So that doesn't really change much, but I'm going to read the statement from Megan McDermott, who is a communications at the county. We are unable to comment on the specific numbers in the PIT count, as some of these numbers appear to be incorrect. With increasing rental costs for housing and the expiration of the state's eviction moratorium, it is sadly unsurprising that there would be an increase in homeless individuals and families in Monroe County. This is an issue Monroe County takes very seriously, which is why we need the county executive's housing plan to move forward expeditiously. We need more affordable housing open as soon as possible, and the county executive's plan would accomplish that. Monroe County contracts with four local agencies to provide family shelters, Catholic Charities, BOA, YWCA, and TemPro. As well, the county contracts with local hotels to act as overflow. At present, Monroe County DSS has 108 families in placements. That includes 41 families in shelters and 67 families in hotels. Those placements comprise 338 individuals, 118 adults, and 220 children. We are not aware of any families with children who are unsheltered. In 2023, Monroe County spent $8.8 million providing emergency housing placements, reflecting a significant increase over the $5.7 million spent in 2019, an increase that reflects both more placements and increased per diem payments to shelters. In coming weeks, Monroe County will announce a project that more than doubles our capacity to shelter families. That is from Megan McDermott, Communications at Monroe County. Let's start off by saying there's a project they're going to announce soon. Do we want to talk about that project right now? Let's get the scoop on them. Let's go right ahead. Andy, we'll start with you. You want to talk about that project?
Sure, I'd be happy to speak to that. I actually just got to tour the facility. It's been in the news quite a bit about the new family shelter moving into the Cornhill area, right by 490 on Plymouth. So we're really excited that VOA is going to be able to launch that. It's a big project. I'm always amazed by the size of it. But I think it'll be about 58 families worth of people going into a building. And that's fantastic. And we're all here to support them. And I hope it goes very well for them.
Well, after reading that statement, I'd like to give some responses for you. Do you think the county is doing enough right now to address this issue? Most of the homeless services come through the county level. And it begs the question of, obviously, county officials will say that we are doing everything we can and we are doing, we are making this a priority. But do you think that's true? Anna, let me start with you. Do you think the county is doing enough? I'll put you right on the spot.
We have a very close working relationship with the county, so I'm not going to necessarily speak for the job they're doing and if they're doing enough or not enough. I'd actually respond by taking it a level or two higher to say that I think that a lot of why we're here actually has to do with federal policy as when it comes to housing and alleviating homelessness in our communities. I think of something like 12 years ago, HUD really stopped funding other housing models like transitional housing, emergency, really exclusively focused on permanent supportive housing, which is absolutely necessary. It prioritizes a chronically homeless population. Those things are very, very important. But there's always another side, to when we shift policy that drastically. And that's that when you focus exclusively on one housing model and one subpopulation, you're letting all the other housing models and populations fall through the cracks. And so that's why we're seeing this increase in households that otherwise just aren't suited to these mainstream shelters and programs. So is the county doing enough? Again, I'm not going to answer that directly, but I think they're at least responding in this way. They're responding to an issue that, that is needed, but it's not enough. My question would be I was asking this earlier, what qualifies a family to be able to enter into this shelter? That's really my biggest question. And hopefully they can answer that, because what we see is people who are really falling through the cracks. And so if this program allows for a really kind of diverse qualification process, then great. And if it doesn't, then really we're going to continue to be faced with the same issues that we're dealing with right now.
So I got a call right now from someone who I think would like to answer that question directly. County Legislator Rachel Barnhart.
Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Rachel. Are you there?
Yes. Thank you so much, Gino, for taking the call. I had to pull over. I was driving and I heard Megan McDermott's statement. And first, let me just thank your panel and all of the wonderful work that they do in our community. And thank you for hosting this show. Just a couple quick points here. It's disturbing that the county, in their statement, that their initial response is to sort of downplay the crisis in our community. And while I completely agree with Anna's assessment that state and federal policy has got to change, and we've got to treat housing like an entitlement as we do food. But we don't do that right now. So 100% in agreement. But there are things that we can do locally. We have a lot of money locally that we could put towards this problem. For example, we have a lot of remaining American Rescue Plan Act funds. And Megan McDermott referenced the county executive's housing plan. He announced a $7.8 million plan using American Rescue Plan Act funds. Nothing in that plan would have provided direct aid to renters, would not have provided any stability to tenants. One component of the plan was peer navigators, help people find apartments. The other component was mediation, prevent evictions. Another component was rental repairs, try to get more units online through repairing them. And then the final one was a landlord incentive program where you're going to give landlords cash and provide a little insurance money to incentivize them to take extremely low-income tenants. But what she didn't say was of that $7.8 million, only $4.25 million survives because nobody responded to the rental component RFP, is my understanding. So that plan has now been cut in half to a mere $4 million, and nothing in it provides the relief that people need. I mean, we've had thousands of evictions so far this year, and I'm sure your panel would say a big problem, and some people have very complex problems, but some people actually just need rent money because their incomes are too low to bridge the gap between what a unit costs and what they're earning. And there is not that kind of aid in this housing plan. Now, yes, there are programs like Project Anchor and ERAP, but they're strapped. We just need, it's like trying to use a garden hose to put out a forest fire. So I'll leave it at that. I think there's more that we can do, more with American Rescue Plan Act funds. I'm very disappointed that there's not more funding for housing. And I do think that we really need to get over our aversion of helping people directly to keep them in units, whether it's security deposits, first month's rent, rental arrears, or even a rental subsidy. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Rachel. So I think that's a good segue here to talk about the eviction moratorium ending. That pandemic era put in place prevented a large amount of, a massive amount of evictions from going through between January 2020 and January of 2022. The total number of evictions for last year has pretty much returned to pre-pandemic numbers. It was about 8,700, I believe, for the total year, right around that area. And that is similar to what we saw in years prior to the pandemic. But this is a topic that keeps coming up over and over when we have these conversations, is the end of that moratorium and how it played into what we are seeing now. Connie, I'll start with you there. I mean, what impact do you think that moratorium ending had on the population that we're seeing now?
So I think in addition to the eviction moratorium ending, there was like a perfect storm of events. With the eviction moratorium, New York State, the eviction moratorium lasted longer than any other state in the country. While that moratorium remained in effect, the backlog of the housing or eviction cases just kept building up in housing court. And so you see that huge, tremendous increase in evictions. And as you mentioned, now it seems to be going back a little bit. But more important than just the evictions is, I know our programs, Andy, I'm sure Anna has landlords that they work with, that those relationships were really jeopardized because they were not allowed to gain back possession of their property. I know landlords have a bad name, and there are some bad landlords, but they can't take care of their properties if they're not getting rental income. So we've seen a huge decrease in the number of rental units overall, and certainly a huge increase in the number of affordable rental units. So I think that impacts so many places. Why people can't stay doubled up with family and friends. That original tenant, whatever you want to call it, is probably in a unit that isn't even big enough for their own family because of a cost of what the rent is. And then bringing somebody else in, they may do it, but it may last for a much shorter period of time than it did prior.
Andy, what do you think the role played, too, of the eviction moratorium? What have you seen?
I think it was a shock to our system. So I think before the pandemic, we slowly built up to this ridiculously high amount of evictions of 8,700 a year or whatever. And then all of a sudden it stopped. And also our systems became a little more fragile, harder to find workers coming back. It was a difficult time. And then it jumped from nothing back up to 8,700 in almost no time. And that's just insurmountable for most systems. So the capacity of the systems couldn't really help as much as it used to. And so I think it's had a profound effect. And I know I'm very close with a lot of small landlords, and they had a hard time. They don't have the money to fix up their buildings. They're having issues with CFOs. You know, I think Rachel spoke to a little bit about it. But I think when you think about ARPA funding and funding the problem, some of it has to be preservation money that you can give small local landlords in order to help rebuild their buildings so that they're good, adequate accommodations for people. You know, that's one of many, many solutions. I think that's another thing. We kind of went to this permanent housing model, which is, you know, beautiful. I love the buildings. I'm super happy that people can have nice, affordable housing. It looks great in the city. But I think there's a lot of other tools we're not using as a county and a city. You know, we have to support our emergency shelters, our transitional housing, like Anna was talking about, rehab the old zombie buildings. You know, there's so many things we could do. And sometimes we get micro-focused on one solution. And building housing is super important. We're going to need a lot of it. But all housing aspects are important, or we're not going to be able to combat homelessness. So
I just want to add a note here that we're talking about ARPA dollars related to this stuff. And for those listening that don't know what ARPA is, it's American Rescue Plan Act. That was a federal COVID relief that went through in 2021. And it was very broadly able to be used for pretty much anything that could have been affected by the pandemic. That ranges from housing to tourism, everything in between. And the issue that I would bring up on the expenditure of ARPA dollars in relation to addressing the homeless population is, in the short term, it can be a valuable tool. It's money that can be injected into the problem, but it's also one-time money. And if you put it into doing something that is addressing an ongoing problem with temporary funds, how long can you feasibly expect to make a difference? And what I would say is a broader issue here is when we're talking about the housing price increases and the lack of availability of housing, we're talking about in 5 years, a one-bedroom apartment in Rochester, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, went up 38%. In 5 years, 38%. From about $792 to over $1,100 for a one bedroom in Rochester. The recent city reassessment saw the average house price go up 68%. We saw some neighborhoods where they went up over 100%. On average, some houses went up 200-300%. So the options come down to this problem of there's less affordable housing being built. The housing that exists is becoming more and more scarce, more and more expensive, and the evictions are returning at a rate that was high to begin with, and now it's back to normal with all of that backdrop behind it. What are people supposed to do is the question. What is the way out of it? And Anna, I'll turn to you on this. I mean, what – with this whole backdrop of everything that is happening, how unaffordable Rochester is becoming for a lot of people as far as housing goes, what can we do in the long term to prevent more and more people entering the shelter system? How can we create that stability?
Well, I think I would actually echo one of the points Rachel made about actually giving direct assistance to renters, first of all. One thing that we did we have to redo this. I think based on the 38% increase, you know, we would see this. But years ago, when we first opened our cold water house, we did a test to see for people that we couldn't take in the house at the time because we were full. We did a little snapshot of their background to identify like an average amount of money it would take to actually prevent them from entering the system altogether. And at that time, this is pre-COVID, it was about $1,500 per household just to prevent entering the shelter system altogether. That's a very small amount of money considering, you know, the cost that it would take to actually house them for 6 months, a year, whatever it was. So we started our own kind of eviction prevention program internally to be able to help families who might be able to sustain that if we were given them that one-time assistance. And it was highly effective. We provided services for 62 families in the first year. All but one remained stably housed for a full year after. So we know that things like that that actually provide direct assistance can be very, very effective. That's one thing I would echo that I think would be helpful. The other thing, and this is kind of, you know, Open Door, when people complete our programs, we want to know that if possible, which we know it's not always possible, but we want people not to just be able to access affordable housing. We want them to afford housing. So we have to look at not just, you know, access to, you know, units that are subsidized. But to Andy's point, you know, we don't just want to be building new housing where we're consolidating the issue all in one place. We want to spread it out and have landlords returning that have assistance to be able to maintain properties, safe, clean properties that are, you know, scattered throughout the, you know, throughout the area. And also importantly, we want people who are coming through these programs and systems to get to the point that they're working and that they're able to afford their housing so that, you know, we're not just kind of bottlenecking all of these programs into one place where it's going to all we're going to have to do is continue to create more housing like that. So we should be spreading out, you know, to Andy's point too, spreading out how we're solving the issue with not just one housing model, multiple housing models, multiple paths to employment, to long-term sustainability.
Andy, I think you deal with a lot of people that are chronically homeless that have been on the street for a long time. And I don't want to make you the simple question of like, what do we do about that? It's more like your shelter that I visited back in December has a unique model of kind of like a dormitory environment where people do have a bit of independence, privacy that they might not see at a lot of other shelters. I guess what measures do you think could be taken to stabilize that population of giving them some kind of opportunity to be in a place that, you know, is something that could be long term, even if it's unorthodox out of the idea of, you know, traditional housing. I think you have a project that you've been working on that I think might play into here. So, I just want you to talk a bit about what you see there and what possibilities exist.
Yeah, and I really do feel like there are solutions, and I'm glad you brought that up. So when we see chronically homeless individuals out on the streets and we feel, you know, they're so marginalized, so vulnerable, and people kind of feel hopeless, and I feel the opposite. I think I was amazed by how the county, city, Open Door Mission, House of Mercy, Reach came together at the beginning of the pandemic. Suddenly we could rapidly move 120 chronically homeless individuals into hotel rooms, staff it, work with people so that they could, you know, think about, you know, social work is definitely a profession and peers and everybody. And you work people through stages of change and you need to motivate people to, and yet give people time. And that time that we bought during the pandemic was incredible. I saw so much change. People had their own space, very dignified, really nice for kind of trauma-informed care. People could think about things. A lot of times we'll house somebody, they go into the apartment, close the door, and it's dead silent. And all of a sudden you're alone when you're used to being in community all the time, community meals, community shelters, and all the symptoms come crashing down and all these other things that you weren't ready to deal with happen. Whereas at the hotel, you got used to that. And you also started to think about, well, maybe I do want my own place and what can I do to get that? And with that time and that model, that was fantastic. So obviously, after the hotels were done, we tried to move that into our shelter system so we could do individual rooms, which doesn't really fit the shelter model for funding, but we're working on it. And then you take it a step further and you start thinking about treatment for the opioid epidemic. You know, people are coming in much more ill. They have there's no heroin in the heroin. It's all fentanyl, xylazine. People are coming in at a whole different level of illness, taking a lot longer to kind of clear up and work through treatment. And so you start thinking about things like in Harlem, the overdose prevention centers, you know, things like that that I know are difficult for communities to grasp. But really, it's about keeping people alive and then watching them move forward. And what I love is a lot of the guests from the Hotel Times and Past Times in the REACH low barrier shelters are now staff or now working other jobs or doing asbestos removal. You know, people that really 5 years ago, most people would have said, that guy doesn't have a chance. And then suddenly, with a little bit of support and a little bit of dignity, they move forward. It's incredible.
There's no heroin in the heroin is a very daunting phrase.
Yeah, it's a scary new thing.
And it's Narcan resistant. So.
Right. That makes it incredibly hard.
So is that the xylazine is Narcan resistant or fentanyl?
A lot of them are.
Yeah. So when we're like when we're out doing outreach and we run into people and you hit them with a few Narcans, you're doing chest compressions until the EMTs come. The EMTs around here work miracles. I don't know how they do it. And then. But it's not like it used to be. I used to be able to just one Narcan, person pops up, a little upset that I ruined their high, but
it's scary. It's very scary. We did some reporting a few months back when the overdose totals came out, and I mean, the presence of heroin in the toxicology reports was almost non-existent, which is just – it's a scary reality that we're living in where there's more synthetic opioids that we've never really seen before entering the market. And, you know, the public health angle of trying to deal with that as it keeps evolving so rapidly is seems kind of hopeless, honestly. That's the difficult thing. But on a brighter note, I want to get an idea of what you think could be done here long term. And we kind of touched on this throughout the run of this show. But, you know, there is some things that some programs that we have tried that have been short term successful. Bigger picture of we're never going to. Well, I guess this is kind of a question. Could we ever really solve homelessness? Can we ever end it completely? But if the idea is that we can never get to that point or that point is, you know, almost infeasible to get to, what is the most humane way of handling the situation and the people that are, you know, experiencing homelessness? And Connie, I'll start with you. Do you think that we can end homelessness overall? And if we can't, what's the most humane way of dealing with
it? And depending on how you define ending homelessness, and even HUD defines ending homelessness, somebody's always going to become homeless. There's probably never any way to prevent that from happening. But what you can do in your community is have enough resources that should that fewer people have to enter the homeless system because there's more diversion or prevention. If they end up entering the homeless system, they're there for shorter periods of time. And then on the other end, there's an ample supply of affordable housing. For some people, it would be affordable housing with support services so that they're, you know, to quote HUD, it's like so that homelessness is a brief one-time occurrence. I think we could get there. I really do think that. But it would be a tremendous amount of work. It means we can't build our way out of it with new housing. That would just take generations to build ourselves out of it. But I do think there would be some ways we could use existing residential units and fix them up and create affordable units for people. And I do think that is the key. For our permanent supportive housing units, our average length of stay is like almost 5 years. So it's a model that works. If people can afford to stay where they are, they have somebody they can meet with when there's issues that come up, they're able to remain stable in housing. And that's just really, I think it's remarkable when you look at some of the people that come into the system and able to stay that long. So it can work. It just takes a tremendous amount of commitment on local, state, and federal government. And again, having some sort of long-term, you know, increase in long-term subsidies for people.
So we're going to take our first and only break of the hour, and we come back. I want to continue on this track and talk more about, you know, what the long-term solutions are.
Coming up in our second hour, a special rebroadcast of a recent edition of Connections focusing on invasive species. Maybe you've seen the headlines on the Joro spider. Turns out it's not even an invasive species, and it shouldn't be a concern to you at all. But there are some invasive species we should know about, from the spotted lanternfly to zebra mussels to the LDD moth to so many others. We're going to talk to the experts next hour.
And we're back, and I want to come read an email here from Ray in Rochester. I'm a low-income senior who was trying to find an apartment in the city of Rochester. Many of the ads for apartments said that you must make three times an income what the rent is. I could afford to pay the rent with assistance from my housing choice voucher. Landlords must accept housing choice vouchers as a form of income, but that would not make up the difference between the rent and the amount that the landlord was requiring to meet the three times an income that the rent would be. The state needs to do something about this. I think what Ray is saying kind of speaks to an issue that we've touched on a bit here of our support systems seem to be just filled with cracks of people that have some kind of means of getting assistance from the state or from the federal government, but it isn't enough to keep them in housing. I'm sure all of you have seen some version of this story at some time or another, but yeah, Andy, I'll start with you. Are our safety nets sufficient right now? Are they built to prevent people from, you know, falling through the cracks?
Yeah. In my opinion, currently, no, just because of the rapid increase in rent and everything else and the lack of increase, you know, say you get Social Security and just recently they finally did another cost of living adjustment, but it's just a few percent. It's not hitting the 38% that rent went up, you know, so all our systems are so far behind. And I think that's where a city like Rochester and our leaders and community in general really has to push on state and federal folks to give more money. Like the idea that to get temporary assistance at DHS and you get $440 a month as an individual, $257 of that's your rental allotment, $183 is your personal needs allotment. That was done sometime in the late 80s. You know, that's just not real anymore. And I understand it's expensive to get benefits out to everybody, but we really do, as a society, have to start thinking in different ways. Maybe not everyone will be working. Maybe we do have to figure out some other stuff to help people get through. And certainly when they're in times of need, if you're in treatment or you have significant mental health symptoms or there's some sort of transition in your life, the support then needs to be higher.
Anna, what do you think about just in general our systems that we have in place? It almost seems like to me that we are waiting for people to literally end up on the street or in the shelter before we offer them a lifeline to, you know, help them in some degree.
So, and that's almost exactly the case. and I would add to that, yeah, it's we either require people to be completely dependent permanently or completely on their own, where they're susceptible to falling through the cracks and sleeping on couches and floors and unable to sustain any sort of healthy lifestyle. So absolutely, the system is not working. And I think a lot of that is because we kind of put ourselves in a box, you know, and, you know, we don't, you know, not to get like political, but because we're so divided on this issue and there's no working across the aisles to get what's best of one side and the best ideas from the other side and work together to come up with solutions. We want to find a solution that encompasses and embraces the full potential of people. You know, when we look at, you know, the HUD numbers are counting mostly what HUD-funded programs are doing.
Exactly.
That's what they're counting. They're leaving out hundreds, if not thousands, of other programs that exist all throughout the country that are not being, that are doing things in different ways, in unique ways. A program like ours that's, you know, that faith, we're part of a national network of organizations that are Christian rescue missions. There's like 330 organizations in that. Most of them are not represented in HUD numbers and in their best practices, you know, documents. So we're missing a lot of the pieces. And I think as we watch people continue to fall through the cracks, we have to look at how we approach our solutions to homelessness in a diverse way. We have to, we cannot box everyone into one housing model and one housing population. We have to look at the bigger picture and then start putting the pieces together.
I mean, it's both surprising and unsurprising to me that this has become like a politically divisive issue. Like almost everything that exists in the world right now has become a politically divisive issue. But this one in particular, it's, I mean, it seems like to me, one, it's human compassion. Yeah, some people have made bad choices that they end up on the street for. Some people don't. Some people are just really unlucky. Some people are born in really bad situations. Some people end up in really bad situations that they didn't prepare for. I think it does frustrate with me when people kind of boil the homeless population down to, oh, they're lazy and they don't want to work, when that is really that maybe there are a couple out there that are like that. But that's not really the case overall. There's a lot more nuance to it than that. And I would add too that if you're the kind of person listening that feels that way, you're a short run of bad luck and from ending in the same situation too. Much, much closer than living in a, you know, $10 million mansion or something like that. So, but in the political climate we're in, I think you're right. There is no progress forward that can happen here. There's no inroads. So what does the future look like if this trend continues? Connie, I'll turn to you on that. Where are we heading right now?
It's so hard. It's so difficult to tell because I'm pretty old. So I've seen lots of cycles of different things. And we've seen housing costs go up before. But right now, I think it's a very unique situation in that it doesn't seem like the market is going to correct itself. So we have this larger number of people competing for the same, well, actually a reduced number of rental units. So people who would have been, for example, purchasing their first homes are in rental units now that wouldn't have been 4 or 5 years ago, definitely before COVID. I think we need to rethink this. If the market doesn't correct itself, then I think we need to focus on increasing. I know everybody wants home ownership opportunities. It is a wonderful thing, but you know, affordable rental can solve issues for people that a home ownership does for, you know, like a young family or a young person trying to get going in this world. I just think it's difficult to see whether it can correct itself.
Andy, we continue on this road. Where do you think we're headed?
actually, I think it's going to force the community to force the politicians to not be divided like that. I think it gets to a point. I say it all the time. I really am grateful that I get to walk around these neighborhoods every day of the week. And it really will come to the point where you have to fix this problem for us, or you won't be in office. And I think that we are so divided on a national level, local level, all over. But I think there are some common things that can really push people to try and figure out solutions. And in my opinion, we don't have to have homelessness in Rochester. I think it's a solvable problem in my world. And it's something that I think any group of politicians would want to do. And I hope that they will do. We'll see.
I appreciate the optimism. I'll turn to you. We have about a minute left. But yeah, the track we're on, I mean, are you hopeful that things could improve, that people might make a change? It seems kind of bleak right now, but Where do you think we're heading?
It does. And I think I said this to you last week, Gino, that I wouldn't still be doing this work after almost 20 years if I wasn't still hopeful. So, you know, we see the nice thing about the work that we do, all of us here on this panel do, is that we get to see miracles happen every day. We get to see lives changed every single day. And so I think our goal is to continue to do that and to continue to represent those stories with our elected officials to drive more long-term permanent change. And the more the community knows about the things that we're doing, the more they can support us as well. You know, we're looking at expanding our bed count as well in our shelter to add some of those non-congregate beds as well, because that gives people something to work towards. Right now they're in an open dorm setting, but, oh, hey, I might actually have a chance at my own room for, you know, an extended 2 weeks or 4 weeks at a time. And, you know, so every step that we're taking to try to do the work that we're doing, we kind of nose to the grindstone work, you know, we are seeing lives changed. And I think we also were blessed to be in a community that works very well together, too.
All right. Well, Andy, Connie, and I appreciate you all being here. This is a really good conversation, I think, a really important issue. I also recommend anyone listening to read our report at WXXINews.org that goes into the details of the pit count and some of the implications of it. But I'm Gino Finelli. I'm an investigative reporter here at WXXI, and thanks for tuning in.
Thank you.